from the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal. This is Free Expression with Jerry Baker.
Hello and welcome to Free Expression from the Wall Street Journal. I'm Jerry Baker, editor-at-large of the Journal. If you're not already a subscriber, please do sign up wherever you do your podcast listening. This week, sex, lies, and a president on trial. Now, most of us may be inured by now, or numbed might be a better word, to the endless cycle of sordid stories, allegations of presidential misconduct, and politically motivated lawfare pursued by his opponents, but some moments can still seize our jaded attention. We had one of them this week in the trial of former President Donald Trump in a Manhattan courtroom, with live testimony from Stormy Daniels, the porn actress at the center of the story of payments made by Trump to keep quiet information about a sexual encounter between the two of them in a Lake Tahoe hotel room in 2006. It was, on the face of it, a very questionable move by prosecutor Alvin Bragg to put Ms. Daniels on the stand. Mr. Trump doesn't contest that an encounter took place between them, nor that he paid money to keep it from becoming public. He merely disputes whether that payment violated any federal laws. So the appearance of Ms. Daniels on the stand looks suspiciously like an attempt by the prosecutor, with of course the helpful approval of the judge, to present legally superfluous but salacious and potentially embarrassing information about Mr. Trump, all designed to defame his character before the jury and before the wider public. And so it was, with Ms. Daniels answering questions about her recollections of the evening and such critical legal details and facts as the state of Mr. Trump's wardrobe, what he said about the state of his marriage, and a whole range of other things that I'm not even going to begin to discuss on a family-oriented podcast. Trump's lawyers had objected to Ms. Daniels' testimony and must have been struck by the irony when Judge Juan Merchan actually said at one point during a break, "I agree that it would have been better if some of these things had been left unsaid." But did this move in any way advance the prosecution case? Might it actually backfire, offering Trump's lawyers an avenue for appeal if he should be convicted by a New York jury? They did, after all, call for a mistrial as a result of Ms. Daniels' testimony. How is the wider trial going now? Has Alvin Bragg yet managed to explain how Trump's attempts to keep the encounter quiet might somehow amount to a crime? Well, with me this week to dig into the lurid details, and I'm very hopeful to elevate our minds for a wider view of the progress of the case so far and its implications, I'm very pleased to be joined by Andy McCarthy. Andy, as I'm sure you all know, is a former federal prosecutor who, among other things, secured the conviction of the perpetrators of the first attack on the World Trade Center in New York in 1993. He's now a commentator and columnist for National Review, and he writes for other publications, and he's a fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. He's the author of several books, and he joins me now. Andy McCarthy, thanks very much for joining Free Expression.
Jerry, it's my pleasure.
So we must, of course, turn our attention to the inevitable, rather sordid spectacle that we had this week in the Manhattan courtroom when Stormy Daniels testified. It was, as expected, and certainly as intended, presumably by the prosecution, kind of pretty salacious stuff, even though, you know, there were attempts to kind of curb what she could say. Trump's lawyers, obviously, firstly, had not wanted her to testify. There's no real disagreement about the facts. Everybody agrees whatever kind of encounter it was took place. Everybody agrees some money was paid to her. Is this just pure, you know, salacious performance by the prosecution just to sort of further kind of muddy Trump's name and reputation and somehow further kind of turn the jury against him?
It's hard to see any other reason to do this because, just as an objective proposition, the idea that the graphic details of a sexual encounter in 2006 would be relevant to proving the way the bookkeeping procedure that was adopted 11 years later in connection with payments that everybody agrees, as you just mentioned, everybody agrees happened and everybody agrees were booked, is pretty absurd. The legal test that always applies when you're dealing with evidence that's arguably relevant is whether its probative value is outweighed by prejudicial impact to the defendant. In other words, sort of waving the bloody shirt at the jury, getting them to convict on the basis of things that are not really evidence, but appeals to emotion. And the other thing is if it's outweighed by potential for jury confusion. So for example, if you set up a situation, which I think Bragg has set up here, that the jury could end up believing that if Stormy is telling the truth and Trump is lying about whether this affair or tryst or whatever you want to call it that happened in 2006, or that she says happened that he denies, if they think he's lying, does that mean they think that the business record entries are false. So you could have a situation where the jury is confused because they have to figure if the judge let this evidence in, it's relevant to something. And if we conclude that Trump is lying, does that mean his business records are false? So there's a lot of good reasons to have kept this proof out just as a straight legal matter. But having it in the case is pretty consistent with everything that we've seen up until now, beginning with the fact that you have a prosecution that this particular progressive Democratic elected district attorney wouldn't have brought against anyone else.
And just put ourselves in the unusual position, maybe of being fair to brag. I mean, this is the kind of thing prosecutors want to try on all the time, I guess, isn't it? I mean, you've been a prosecutor. You'd love to have witnesses with no particular, I mean, I'm not suggesting she has no relevance to the case, but witnesses testifying in ways that are not directly relevant to the issue at hand, you know, which defame the character of the defendant and sort of leave a nasty feeling about the defendant. So every prosecutor presumably would try and get away with this if he could. It's the judge's decision to allow this, that's really the controversial and the questionable thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the judge is supposed to be the impartial arbiter. And, you know, prejudice is a word that gets thrown around a lot. I remember there's a famous federal judge who used to say that the purpose of all admissible evidence is to prejudice the defendant. The question is whether it's unfairly prejudicial or not. And that's what the judge is there for, to sort out what's absolutely relevant and ought to be proved versus that which the prejudicial impact of it is so vast compared to the negligible probative value that it should be out of the case. And here we have a situation where the charges in the case, as opposed to what Bragg, I think, has spun them into, is the charges in the indictment are 34 felony falsification of business records counts. Bragg is presenting the case as if it were a conspiracy to steal the 2016 election by suppressing negative information in violation of the federal campaign finance laws that he doesn't have any authority to enforce. So you have a disconnect between what the indictment actually says, what the prosecutor is trying to show the jury. And thus far, the judge should be the one to call a foul on that one. And to this point, Judge Merchan has been in lockstep with the district attorney, Bragg. No matter how controversial what Bragg seems to want to do here, the judge backs him rather than questioning him. And I think that came to a head in Stormy Daniels' testimony, because after letting the testimony in, the judge then scolded the prosecutors for basically proving and eliciting from Stormy the testimony that the judge had told them they could elicit. And maybe he got hit over the head by how graphic it was and the impact it may have had on the jury. I don't want to pretend to be able to read his mind, but he certainly sounded like he had some remorse about it.
Yeah, that's right. I think the quote was, I agree, it would have been better if some of these things had been left unsaid, but this is exactly the testimony that he opened up by allowing this to go ahead, right?
Exactly right. I mean, literally, he told them they could do it and then got mad at them for doing it.
So what are the legal implications here, the procedural implications here, Andy, in terms of Trump's options? I mean, I say the lawyers asked for a mistrial. Obviously, that wasn't allowed. But this presumably strengthens the steadily strengthening case on appeal, should he be convicted, that his lawyers have, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. But it could be cold comfort here. You know, it was probably within the last 10 days or so that Harvey Weinstein's conviction was overturned in New York. And given the unfairness of that trial, that's a good thing as a legal matter, not carrying a brief for Harvey Weinstein here. But the point is that I think his trial was about 3 years ago. So it takes a very long time to work something through the appellate process. And given the other things at stake here, I don't think it's going to be much comfort to Trump if he gets an acquittal from the Court of Appeals in 2026 or whenever it'll be.
What about the impact you think on, and you've argued before juries many times of this kind of thing? I mean, I just wonder whether this might backfire, even in this case, even with, you know, we don't know what this jury is, but it's a New York jury. Reminds me a little bit, when you go into this kind of level of salacious detail, it's obviously a different in important respects, but you remember the Ken Starr report into Bill Clinton, which led to Bill Clinton's impeachment over his lying about his affair with Monica Lewinsky, and you will all remember the lurid details that were included in that, which sort of seemed to kind of, I think, although I understand exactly why Starr did it, it seemed seemed to suggest the whole thing was a kind of just a sort of really kind of sordid, salacious business. And I think it probably helped to turn a lot of people off. Do you think, again, knowing how the way juries work, is this the kind of thing that you think either is going to may work in the way the prosecution wants and just make them think what a kind of a scumbag Trump is? Or could it actually make them think, you know what, if they have to do this kind of thing, if they have to drag this sort of testimony in, is their case really that strong?
Yeah, well, I guess a couple of things about that. I'm not as down on Manhattan juries and New York juries as many people are. I don't assume that Trump simply can't get a fair trial in Manhattan. In my experience, I mean, I tried a lot of cases in Manhattan. Now, my cases were federal, which means we were drawing a jury pool that included the Bronx, which really isn't much different from Manhattan, and Westchester County, which is kind of a mixed bag. But I thought Manhattan jurors were fine. I cop to the fact that I haven't tried a case in 20 years in New York. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. But I don't think people should assume that just because 80,000 people, which is a vanishingly small percentage of New York County, which is Manhattan, that 80,000 people vote for Alvin Bragg, a committed out-and-out progressive, to be their prosecutor, necessarily means that those 80,000 are representative of what the jury pool in Manhattan is. I think there's probably, I'm not pretending that this is Trump country, but, you know, I think he's got a 1 out of 3 people in Manhattan probably have some political sympathy for him. And the other thing that's important, Jerry, which is overlooked a lot, is Trump only needs one. Bragg is the one who needs 12. Trump doesn't really need to be acquitted. What he really needs is a hung jury, which would, I think, put this thing to rest. I doubt that Bragg would try it a second time. It doesn't seem to me at all impossible that he can get one or a handful of jurors. And the other thing I think that is worth noting here is that crime has spiked immensely in Manhattan since 2019. And we have a prosecutor who is notorious in the city for essentially not prosecuting. His normal default position is to plead felonies down to misdemeanors or something even less than that so as not to prosecute. So the way he's handling this case is very different from the way he handles the normal case in New York. New York is crime-ridden. There may very well be people on that jury who will wonder, how is it that we can't get ordinary, troublesome crime in New York City addressed, but that Bragg somehow can throw 15 lawyers and all kinds of resources at this, what is usually a misdemeanor business records case. And here, you know, he wouldn't even bring a misdemeanor case against anyone else other than Trump. And here, he's taken what's a misdemeanor and completely out of character for him, inflated into 34 felonies for which Trump could, in theory, be sentenced to 136 years imprisonment. That's not the Alvin Bragg that most people in New York know.
So I want to move on to some of the other lawfare cases that we seem to be seeing against Trump. We're now a couple of weeks into this trial. We've still got big testimony, particularly, I suppose, Michael Cohen, right, still to come. But we've had now quite a few witnesses, and you've been watching it carefully. And again, you've just laid it out again there very clearly, that the highly questionable nature of this prosecution trying to make a federal crime out of a what seems to be, a at best, a state misdemeanor, fraudulent bookkeeping or whatever. What do you make of it so far? And again, given that you actually perhaps are more than others very much willing to give this jury credit and say they'll actually decide the case according to the facts and the law, what's your sense so far?
Well, it's very hard to make a call on that unless you're actually physically present in the courtroom and can observe how the body language of the juries. I always mention to people that appellate courts will not throw out cases if it's on the basis of credibility findings that have been made for the district by the trial judge. And that's because they respect the fact that there's a difference between being in the room and being able to see the witnesses, not only read the cold transcript, but see how people are reacting to testimony. That's really important. I haven't been in the room, so it's hard to say. And the reason I think it's important is I think the unseen dynamic, especially in a criminal trial, that's more important than anything else, is how the jury takes its cues from the judge. Like, how does the jury feel about the judge? And then how does the judge interact with the prosecutors? If the jury likes the judge and the judge seems to be respectful of the prosecution, which means it doesn't mean that he's got to address them in a particular way, but if he treats the case like it's a very serious offense, that's always good for the prosecutors. The reason I mention all that is I think that may have started to break down yesterday. If the judge is getting testy with the prosecutors and any of that is being communicated directly or indirectly to the jury, then the tide could turn for Bragg in a bad way. And the case is not a strong case. You know, there's a lot of unsavory behavior that's been covered, but in terms of a legal case, the offense is not serious and the proof with respect to state of mind, to me, seems to be non-existent. For example, Bragg has to prove fraudulent intent beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not enough for him to show that there were false entries made on Trump's books. He's got to show, even for a misdemeanor, he would have to show that that was done beyond a reasonable doubt with fraudulent intent. I don't see any fraud here. You know, I see a lot of shenanigans with the bookkeeping, but nobody got defrauded. There's no tax count here. There's no allegation that anybody got swindled. So I wonder how serious the jury's going to think this case is, even though the defendant is the most famous guy on the planet.
Do you think Trump will testify? You're a prosecutor, not a defense lawyer. But I mean, well, again, we've got to see Michael Cohen's testimony yet. And I assume that could be tough for the prosecution too, right? Because there's so much credibility about him on the line. But at some point, I suppose Trump's got to decide whether to testify. What would you think?
Yeah, there's two decisions that have to be made by the defendant. His lawyers can counsel him, but the defendant has to make the decision. One is whether to plead guilty and the other is whether to testify. So this will be Trump's call. If I'm the lawyer, I don't want him on the stand, because my point is that I don't think Bragg has proved his case. And I also think because of the pretrial rulings that the court has made and now allowing Stormy Daniels to testify, that puts Trump in a very awkward position. If he testifies, it will come before the jury that in the civil fraud trial, a judge found him to be a persistent fraud. And a number of us may think that that case is as much nonsense as this case is, you know, this $500 million supposed fraud with no fraud victims.
Right.
But the jury's not going to hear it that way. What the jury's going to hear is a judge found him to be a persistent fraud. And then the judge has also said that E. Jean Carroll's, the defamation verdict in that civil case can also come out, which it's hard to imagine how that evidence comes in without the sexual misconduct. And that only comes in if Trump testifies. They've been told they're allowed to impeach him with it. And now that Stormy has testified, I think the jury would be expecting to hear Trump's version of events. And that's a shame, because that escapade shouldn't be in the case. But if Trump gets up there, I can't see, after the jury's heard Stormy's side of the story, I think Trump has to address it. And then you have the problem of, if he's in that position and it turns out they believe her that it actually happened, how much is that going to redound to his detriment? So there's a lot of downside for him to take the stand.
Aside from the fact that he's not the most verbally disciplined of human beings. The gag orders, Andy, we've had multiple fines now, and once again, a threat from the judge. These don't seem to be having any deterrent effect, surprise, surprise, on Trump's willingness to speak out. I mean, he's threatening again. The next one could be imprisonment. Again, you've written about this and you've spoken about this, this idea that a man who is actually at the same time running for president is not allowed to speak out against what he sees with some justification as in a completely unfair, unjustified prosecution is pretty remarkable. I mean, where do you see this going?
If I'm right that this is a political exercise more than a legal one, then it would be politically disastrous, I think, for the Democrats, for the judge to put Trump in custody. So I don't really believe he's going to do that. With all the huffing and puffing this week, Jerry, you noticed that the fine, last week the fine was $9,000. This week it was just $1,000. So he did a lot of finger wagging about potential jail, but he couched all of it. All the people who said he really drew a line in the sand, if you look carefully at what he said, he really didn't. He gave himself a lot of wiggle room. I'd be tempted, I'm only half joking, I'd be tempted if I were Trump to just give the judge a check for $5,000 every Monday to cover this week's contempt and then just go about his business, because I really don't think the judge is going to put him in. And the idea that he shouldn't be able to speak about witnesses, it's not all that abnormal in a case, but it's usually not this one-sided where it's only directed at him and not at the witnesses who were out there speaking about him to their heart's content. But the longer the case goes on, the less justification there is for that term, because those people will already have testified at a certain point. So I think this is more theater than anything else. I don't expect anything really. I can't imagine Trump being put in the Tombs, which is the holding place in Lower Manhattan, or Rikers Island, my God. And the thing I was thinking about as a middle position is he could give him home confinement. There's worse places to be detained than Duplex and Trump Tower. But it would be so obvious that he was doing it in order to prevent him from campaigning. Like, the only way that would be a deterrent is if, like, he couldn't use the Wednesdays to go out and do rallies and use the weekends for that. It would look so obviously political, I think that would backfire on them too. So I think he's going to huff and puff, but I don't think he's going to do much more than that.
We're going to take a short break there. But when we come back, I'll have more with former federal prosecutor Andy McCarthy, and we're talking, of course, about the Trump trial. Stay with us.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
You're listening to Free Expression with Jerry Baker. Don't forget, you can listen to the latest episode anytime on your smart speaker. Just say, play the Opinion Free Expression podcast. Now, back to Jerry Baker.
I'm back with former federal prosecutor Andy McCarthy, and we're talking about the trial of Donald Trump in a Manhattan courtroom on criminal charges brought against him by the district attorney of New York County. Just moving on to other bit of news we had this week in some of the Trump cases was the decision by the judge in the documents case, Cannon, to indefinitely postpone. This had been due to start, I think, later this month, I think, although I guess this whole issue of immunity was going to be hanging over this anyway, and I want to get onto that too. But now it's been postponed. Definitely she referred to pretrial motions and complexity and this kind of stuff. What's your interpretation of that?
I think she's honestly saying that they can't fix the trial date yet. You know, Jack Smith, the prosecutor, sort of goaded her into setting a May 20th trial date, so she did. But those of us who have actually tried classified information cases and have had to deal with CIPA, which is the Classified Information Procedures Act, I think I wrote a column 3 or 4 days after the indictment came out in Florida saying this case will never go to trial in 2024 because CIPA is so difficult to work through. I mean, there's a ton of classified documents in this case. Even one with a more finite amount of that kind of evidence, it's very hard to get through a CIPA litigation because in CIPA, when you're dealing with classified information, all of the admissibility issues about whether classified information comes into the case or not have to be ruled on prior to trial. So everybody knows going in what the jury is going to be allowed to see. That simply takes a lot of time because it doesn't just involve discovery of what the government wants to put in the way of classified documents, but the defense gets to put on a defense. And they always typically ask for, you know, lots of classified information that the government doesn't want to show them. And that takes time to hash that out. And the other thing about CIPA is it provides for pretrial appeals. So how in the world Jack Smith thought that he was going to bring 36 classified information felony charges and get the case to trial in a short period of time was just ridiculously ambitious. And I have to say, Jerry, he's got himself to blame here because he could have brought this case as a slimmed down obstruction case, which still would have had about 40 or 50 years of prison exposure if that was what he was worried about. But he would have been able to get to trial because the only relevant thing would have been whether the documents were actually marked classified. The substance of them wouldn't have made any difference, so he wouldn't have been in this whole CIPA morass. He's the one who chose to frame the case this way, and he's simply dealing with the consequences of it, no matter who wants to blame the judge for that. And the judge hasn't let it get off the rails. She's continuing to schedule proceedings going into July. She hasn't said the case is off until after the election. It's Jack Smith who's obsessed with the election. She said, here's where we're hoping to be at in July, at which point I hope I can schedule a trial date. So I think the criticism of her has been unfair.
Again, you've written this before. It was always a stretch, given the complexities, you know, what's classified and what isn't. It was always a stretch to think this could be done by legal procedural standards such a short period of time.
Yeah, that's right. But the thing is, he had an option open to him. And I must say, he could have revisited that because after the other special counsel decided not to bring a case against Biden that could easily have been brought, the unfairness of this was obvious, where Trump and Biden did the same things. It's the same crime. And they say that the difference between the two things is Trump obstructed the investigation and Biden cooperated with it. Well, that's not a reason not to charge Biden. If you're going to drop those charges against Biden, then drop them against Trump and try him for obstruction, if that's what you say is the difference between the two cases. And I think he should have just pared it down to obstruction, and then he might have had a chance. I think it's unseemly for prosecutors to be looking at the election calendar, as he's very overtly doing. But putting that aside, if he really wanted to get to trial before November, slim it down to a obstruction case.
And just one other question. It seems more good news for Trump in terms of a delay came out today. We're recording this, I should say, Wednesday evening. It's ironic, isn't it? You know, Shakespeare wrote about the law's delay being a terrible thing, but actually it looks like it's very much working to Trump's favor. And this is the Fannie Willis case in Georgia. The Georgia Appeals Court has agreed to review that lower court ruling that, while dismissing her previous amour, shall we say, her once and gone amour, did keep her on the case. And now that's going to be reviewed by Georgia Appeals Court. So again, what's your reaction to that? Again, but this is going to, again, prolong this for some time, one seems.
Yeah, it's really not a surprise, though. The trial judge's ruling didn't make any sense. I mean, once you find that there is a conflict and there's that kind of misconduct, and also say that Tennessee Williams' line, the odor of mendacity hung over me. It takes two to make that kind of an odor, and he only got rid of one of them, you know? So it was pretty obvious what a appeals court was likely to do here. So it's just been done. I actually think Trump is making a mistake here. I mean, I know he wants delay, and maybe that's the sound strategy. I have to say, if I were representing Trump, the one expense I would ask for is I would send a limo to Fannie's house every day to make sure she got to work, because I think she's the best thing he's got going for him in this case.
But this appeals court, I don't know how it works in Georgia, and I don't know what the composition of that appeals court is. It was a subset of the main appeals division?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, the main problem with these things in terms of delay is the general rule is that you only have to litigate a case before one court at a time. We're seeing that with Judge Chuck in Washington, right? She can't take any action on the case because the jurisdiction over it went from her to the DC Circuit to now the Supreme Court.
Right.
You're not allowed to tamper with the record of a case or add to the record of a case while the case is in front of a superior court. You know, no matter how long or no matter what their procedure is for how they hear cases, in terms of time, the trial judge isn't really going to be able to do much on the case. If it takes a couple of months or longer to process the appeal, nothing can happen. All of the pretrial stuff that has to happen in the run-up to a trial is kind of frozen.
All right, so we've covered pretty well the whole field here. We've covered Bragg, we've covered the documents case a little bit, we've covered the Fannie Willis case. I do want to get you a little bit, finally, Andy, on the larger question of the immunity, and particularly the presidential immunity, the case, of course, that was heard before the Supreme Court a couple of weeks ago, and you've written extensively about this. And I just want to take up a particular thing I heard you say, and I think you wrote it too. I heard you say on one of the many podcasts you appear on, but your regular National Review podcast, something very interesting last week, which is that the implications of that Supreme Court hearing, that if Smith is kind of smart, that, as you said, that Trump's lawyers seem to agree that private behavior was, of course, not subject to immunity. So if it were to be kicked back, assuming the court does what people think it will do, which is to say, well, you know, there probably is some presidential immunity for public actions, kick it back to the court to decide, you know, what the lines are. And everybody thinks that's just going to extend the process. Trump's people could appeal, Trump's lawyers could appeal that. But I think you've said something very interesting, which is that, you know, if Smith wants to, he could say, okay, well, since you agree this is private, we will sort of keep this to a very kind of narrow private sphere of the presidential actions, and then we can go prosecute him under that standard. Explain that, if you would, Andy, because I thought it was really interesting, and tell us what the implications could be.
You know, Justice Barrett, Jerry, and Justice Kagan walked John Sauer, who was Trump's advocate before the Supreme Court, through parts of the indictment and got him to concede that the things that the judges highlighted, for the most part, were private behavior that was not amenable of an immunity claim. And it seemed to me that what he conceded was enough for Smith to go to trial on, if he was willing to. Now, this is exactly what I just said he's not been willing to do in Florida, right? Which is strip the case down for the sake of getting it to trial. But I think if he really wants to push that case to trial, and I think he may have more of a motive to push that case to trial because he's got the Obama-appointed judge who clearly doesn't like Trump, and he's got the Washington, D.C. jury pool there. You know, I think Florida is more of a home game for Trump. Washington's going to be very hard for him to win a case in. So if I'm Smith, I certainly think, you know, if I can go to trial on the so-called fake electors scheme, which Justice Barrett got him to pretty much concede that that was private behavior, that that wasn't presidential. And then there's another incident where Trump and one of his private lawyers provide a sworn statement to a court in Georgia, which is allegedly a false statement. You know, if you stitch a few things like that together, he could say to Judge Chutkan, you know, look, let's just go to trial. I'll leave the rest of it on the cutting room floor. Let's go to trial on the stuff that they concede is private. And I think that would have a chance to get to trial prior to Election Day. It would be a shorter case, and he'd be very likely to win it in Washington.
All right. As you look at all this, and again, you know, these cases, there, I think everybody kind of agrees on that some cases are stronger than others, right? Everybody, you certainly yep. think the Manhattan case is the weakest. The Georgia case doesn't look very strong either. The documents case looks pretty strong. The January 6th, or to put it more correctly, the sort of election subversion case, whatever you want to call it, that's questionable too. But as you look at all this, and you think about, you know, again, this extraordinary kind of volley of cases we've seen, what Trump's having to face. And again, there's always been an element of politicized justice in this country. You know, we know that, though I've lived here for 30 years, I come from England where judges aren't elected and prosecutors aren't elected. I'm not suggesting for a second the English system is perfect, but there's always been an element of politics involved in this. Do you think we've sort of crossed a Rubicon here where it will now become absolutely routine that a president, or indeed for that matter, Democratic or Republican for that matter, prosecutors in jurisdictions where they have a legal authority will now sort of routinely go after their political opponents? Is that too bleak a view? Is it possible that we might sort of step back from that?
I don't think we know where it's settled or where it will settle, but I think that they've dismantled enough of the guardrails and the norms that have heretofore applied that wherever we land, it's going to be in a much worse place. I thought, Jerry, it was interesting that Mike Dreeben, who was the lawyer for Smith before the Supreme Court, is looking the court in the eye and saying, you know, you don't have to worry about politicized prosecutions because prosecutors take an oath and they have to go to a grand jury. And, you know, he listed all these internal safeguards in the Justice Department and external safeguards in the law and said, you don't have to worry at all about these kinds of prosecutions. At the moment he said that, Trump, who had a right to be present in the Supreme Court because it's an essential part of the Washington case against him, wasn't in the Supreme Court because he was in Manhattan being tried by Bragg in what is an obviously political case. So it was odd to me if the people you're worried about when you're thinking about all these norms don't even recognize the problem to the point where they would make such an absurd argument under the circumstances they were in, then I think we're going to end up in a very different place. The other problem here is I think this is more of a cultural problem than a legal problem. When I was a young lawyer in New York, I was in a federal system, which is an appointed system, but the New York District Attorney's Office has always been an elected system. When Robert Morgenthau was the district attorney for years and years, I think 2.5 decades in Manhattan, in Alvin Bragg's now job, what a shift. But when Morgenthau was there, if you made an argument to the electorate, elect me and I will use the powers of my office against our political enemies, that would not only have been disqualifying, I think they would have ridden you to Bellevue to see, like, you know, do you have a mental problem? And here we are all these years later, I guess 20 years later, Tish James, the attorney general in New York, runs for election, I think it was in 2017, maybe 2018, promising, elect me and I will use the powers of the office against Trump. And she gets elected in a landslide. Now, that's not a legal problem. That's a much deeper problem. And maybe it's confined to big blue cities and states. But I think that we need to come to terms with the fact that there's a philosophical difference in the governing class of these blue cities. They don't think it's problematic to use government power, even in an aggressive way that makes the process the penalty, in order to achieve their ends and in order to penalize their opposition. That's a very different way of looking at the law than was common not all that long ago.
I guess Democrats will say, and some even some Republicans, some sympathetic voices to them will say, look, there's something unique about Trump, right? We didn't go after Mitt Romney, or we didn't go after George W. Bush, although I think it's fair to say some wanted to. But we didn't prosecute our opponents routinely. There is something quite unique here. You know, you've talked about how strong the documents case is, and that what he did there does clearly, well, again, without prejudicing any trial, does clearly look like he's got a case to answer. What he did over January 6th, I think a lot of people way beyond Democrats would say was way beyond the pale. And so is it really kind of just wholesale lawfare, using the law to go after your political opponents? Or is there something particularly kind of egregious, if you like, about Trump, about his behavior that somehow maybe does merit at least some of this legal action?
You know, I think people always rationalize in the moment that the villain is sui generis, right? That this is only about Trump. It's not going to apply elsewhere. The history of the country, and certainly the way the law evolves, don't work that way. So, for example, in the United States, we had one impeachment in the history of our country up until Nixon's impeachment, right? From 1973 until now, we've had a number of impeachments, and the presidents who haven't been impeached have been investigated with an eye toward impeachment. So everybody must have thought Nixon was sui generis at a certain point too, but that really isn't the way that it's worked out. And I don't see that it makes sense to assume that, you know, this is just a period of time that's directed at Trump and then it'll subside. First of all, once these ways of going about prosecution are shown to work, they'll be used again. That's just the way it goes. But it doesn't make sense to me to say maybe this will just be confined to Trump, when if you look at the polls, Trump has a chance to be the next president. And on the campaign trail, he's promised to be the candidate of retribution. And then, you know, if he wins, the tables are going to be turned on all these guys. So he's virtually promising that this will be a more regular thing. Now, he's got his reasons for doing it. I'm not contending otherwise. But just the trajectory of how the law works and how history works is that, you know, once you break these barriers, you know, it never goes back to how it was before. And I just don't see it. It does my heart no good to say that, because I think that what we're doing to the legal system is a tragedy. But, you know, you can't close your eyes to reality.
Well, on that rather sobering note, Andy McCarthy, once again, for a typically brilliant and judicious analysis of the issues. Thanks very much indeed for joining Free Expression.
Jerry, thanks so much for having me.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. Thanks very much indeed for joining us. Please do join us again next week when we'll have another discussion on one of the key topics driving our world. Thanks again for joining us. Goodbye, and have a great week.